Big D and Bubba. They have a show 5 days a week, but they don't get to say everything that's on their mind. So they have an extra one, and that's how we get the podcast.
I just realized, for the longest time, ever since we've been doing this and you did your podcast song, by the way, it's Patrick singing the podcast song, you have a little bit of Neil Diamond going on. When you say mind, it's Neil Diamond. Here we go.
Big D and Bubba, they have a show 5 days a week, but they don't get to say everything that's on their mind. So,
did you hear it? Did you hear it? That's Neil Diamond, Patrick Diamond.
Big D and Bubba, they have a show 5 days a week, but they don't get to say everything that's on their mind. So they have an extra one, and that's how we get the podcast, the podcast, the podcast. Big D and Bubba podcast, the podcast, the podcast. Big D and Bubba podcast.
My proudest moment.
I'm a big Neil Diamond fan. I like Neil Diamond.
What I think is great is Patrick is completely embarrassed right now because the guy sitting next to him.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, he's like going, that was me singing and sitting right next to me.
Here's the thing. I assume no one I know ever hears this because no one actually listens to the podcast.
Right.
And then you play it in front of people and I go, oh no.
Now, the thing is, you're surprised. Most of the people you don't know listen to the podcast. I get so many Twitter, Facebook, thousands upon thousands of people.
Oh, I'm sure, but I'm just saying, none of my quote unquote friends in the music industry listen to the podcast
until today.
Oh, great.
But we want to welcome Michael Knox.
Michael Knox
is with us.
How's it going, guys?
Good, man.
Michael Knox, this is straight from his Wikipedia page, which I'm pretty sure he did.
It says, do I have a Wikipedia page?
Oh, stop it. Stop it. Why even? Yes. You didn't know that?
No.
You haven't even seen this?
Well, we'll read it for you.
I have not done this.
Okay. Michael Knox, born in Nashville, Tennessee, is an American record producer. He is the son of a rockabilly singer, Buddy Knox.
Which we'll get into later because I think that's cool.
Knox is best known for discovering Jason Aldean and producing all of his albums. He also helped Crossing Dixon sign to Broken Bow Records, the same label to which Aldean is signed, after a friend of his saw the band perform. He's also produced Montgomery Gentry, Trace Adkins,
Is all
others.
This accurate so far?
Yeah, I mean, it's like really old, but, you know, if you want to check more on me, go to a site called musicknox.com. Okay. That's my website.
Well, what you need to do is have somebody on your staff edit your Wikipedia page and update it. Okay, pick up Big
My staff is me and a young lady that's pregnant. So,
she's awesome, by the way, which she grew up about 10 miles from where Patrick grew up.
Yeah, I told her, I said, we're trying to find a way to fire her now she's pregnant, but we can't because we'll get sued. So we got to ride it out now.
I'm not even sure you can make that joke, actually.
It's okay.
Yeah, she knows better than that. She's been around 7 years.
You won two Academy of Country Music Awards in 2010 for Don't You Want to Stay with Jason Aldean and Kelly Clarkson.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm on musicknox.com.
I'm not done. He also got Album of the Year nomination for the CMAs for My Kind of Party as well.
He's also noted for his production work with Jason Aldean resulted in over 25 million shingles. You know it says shingles on your website?
No, it doesn't. On his website?
It says 25 million shingles.
We're country.
It says singles. And 10 million albums sold, blah, 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 blah. Production credits include Thomas Rhett, Trace Adkins, Brantley Gilbert, Frankie Ballard, Hank Williams Jr. more. What's Hank Jr. like to work with?
Oh, it was awesome. We did this something for a Country Strong album, and he came in, and he actually showed up for tracking. We tracked it.
Is that unusual?
Well, I think it was. I think it was because they were like, well, you know, he's going to be here. You got him for 5 hours, so whatever you need him to do. So after we tracked and got the song down, I said, hey, Hank, can we sing it four or five times top to bottom? And just so I can have something to work with and edit later. And he kind of looked at me and he goes, I like you. I'll give you three. So he sang it three times. I edited it and that was the vocal.
Take what you can get, man.
Yeah, it was great. It was he was awesome. I mean, he's Hank Jr., man.
D, I'm going to let you. Michael, you can go ahead and sit down. I'm going to get to where you can see me.
I'm good, man.
Oh, no,
Bubba, I'm a pacer anyway.
Bubba can't see you is the problem. He has a...
He gets it, look, sure. He has a platform.
He's
going to make himself 8 inches taller now.
Yeah, we're not joking. Like
he's going to put his big, and here
now.
Comes the big.
You got to be how tall to ride
now
this
I can
ride?
See you better.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I would think that Hank Williams Jr. would, because you hear all the stories, you know, and how it's he's difficult to work with. And
I heard he's not difficult to work with. I heard that if he's sober, then he's the greatest person to work with.
I didn't notice him difficult to work with. He's just in his own world, you know. And you got to remember, I caught myself three or four times in the studio with him giving a reference about him, because you forget you're in there with Hank Jr., a guy who invented some things. So you find yourself in there talking to a guitar player, and you're like, hey, man, you got to make that sound a little more rowdy like a Hank Jr. And then Hank Jr. standing right next to me, and you forget that you're actually working with Hank Jr. And so you find yourself doing that in the studio, and that's the great thing with me is I get a big kick out of that.
I bet he appreciates that, though.
Yeah, if it registers. You know, I mean, he's in his own world, man. I mean, he's Hank Jr., man. He's like an Elvis.
We've had him on the show a couple times, and I don't know if he's like this with you, but like every time he comes on the show, he's in Bo Cephas mode. He's like, hey, boys, hard,
it's like Foghorn Leghorn.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was more laid back with us because we were, I did two things with him. I did the popcorn Sutton thing with him. Yeah. And then I did the thing for Country Strong. And he probably don't even remember me, but he kept calling me producer man, you know. So, but it was great, you know. But,
hey,
but I was having a blast. I was having a blast with it, you know. But Hank Jr. treated me great, you know. He never, no disrespect at all. And
except for producer boy.
Yeah. Well, it didn't matter,
hey,
you know.
Producer boy.
It didn't matter because he, you know, when he saw me, he knew me. He came up and
I'd like to get another Mimp Julia bar.
All I said is Paul Garden Lake. Horn.
Producer
I
boy.
Say, I say, producer boy.
I like you. I'm going to give you three cuts of this song, producer boy.
That's great.
You like what I do.
Before we dive into even more, I got to get this out because it's important. This is for the podcast, right? Oh, that one? Okay, cool. Valvoline introduced motor oil back in 1866. If you haven't heard, they're the ones who did it, man. They've been reinventing it ever since. Valvoline, when you see their logo, don't think, oh, look, there's a Valvoline place. Go, oh, there's the place that brought us motor oil. And did you also know they're the only American-owned motor oil on the planet?
That's cool.
So emotional.
I am emotional because I think it's cool. 140 years under the hood. Valvoline, thank you guys for sponsoring the podcast. Okay.
So what are we? What are you working on now?
I just finished up the first half of Montgomery Gentry's record, doing their new album, which is awesome. And
you're a good fit for them.
Doing some cool stuff with Terry Clark right now, and that she's releasing up in Canada, and just turned in Al Dean's record the other day, 2 days ago.
You turned it in?
Yeah, we're all done with the new album. The new single comes out in about a week and a half.
What does that feel like? I mean, because obviously you've been working with him forever, so you guys have a comfort level. But what's that feel like knowing that you've got a new song coming out that's going to represent? Because that first single always sets the table for the rest of the album.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're always nervous because he's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and the expectations are greater and greater. And right. Everybody's always looking at that first week sales, and they get caught up in that, not understanding that My Kind of Party was our biggest record. And our first week sales were 170,000 records, but we sold 3 million albums. And then Night Train, we sold 400,000 first week, but we only sold 1.6 million, you know. So they get caught up in that first week, and so everybody gets caught up in that first week, man.
And then you look at some songs that, like, let's go back to, like, Lee Bryce. I know we were talking in the hall about Randy and Lee and all those guys, but Lee Bryce with the one that was on the charts forever, Patrick?
Love Like Crazy.
Love Like Crazy.
Yeah.
That almost took a year
take a year. I think it was 52 weeks.
It was crazy. So, I mean, sometimes you can start slow and build it up. But I guess the pressure with a Jason Aldean is if it starts slow, the record company goes, okay, next one.
Yeah, you get judged real quick at his level. You know, if he comes out of the box with something under 200,000 records, they might think it's a failure when really – he goes six singles deep, and he sells records over a year and a half. And, you know, Night Train's sold consistently 20,000 records for like a year and a half, and he made it to 1.6 million, which was amazing.
Do you know what their, like, break-even point is? I mean, I know this is kind of like, you know, numbers and stuff, but what, like, let's say on a Jason Aldean or something like that, or any major artist, what is a good break-even point? Like, how many albums do they have to sell to pay for everything?
Yeah, I mean... on my end is all I know is what it costs to make the record. And you know, and I think once we sell, you know, the first couple hundred thousand, we're recouped on my end. But now promotion and things like that is a whole nother ballgame.
And that's their end.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, all I got to worry about is record sales.
Just a couple hundred thousand, and we'll be okay.
Yeah, a friend of mine told me gold records are still good, but they're not as good as they used to be. So a gold record's 500,000.
Yeah,
everything's moved on. It's platinum now, baby. Yeah.
Well, they spend a lot of money on new artists, because you're spending $1 million, $500,000 to $1 million on breaking a new act.
And if they do two or three, you get $2 or $3 million on people that may not be selling a bunch of records.
Yeah.
That's why a lot of these, when our new artists come out and they have a huge hit and it's, you think that everyone thinks that all artists are millionaires. And that's not the case. Yeah. They're just not.
It takes several years in some cases for somebody to, once they hit the radio.
I remember talking to Jason, I guess it's been... six or seven years ago.
And when they bought the beach house?
Yeah, when he and his then wife bought the place down in, I forget where it was.
It was down there by Orange Beach area.
Yeah.
But he'd had maybe 10 top 10 songs at the time. And he's like, and we were kind of worried about buying this vacation home.
Yeah. Well, his career went very slow. Even though his record sales, he went gold in the first, 16, 18 weeks when Hicktown came out. Hicktown died in the top 10, at 10, I think. And it still sold that many records. It was crazy. Yeah. And but he wasn't making a lot of money live. You're still only making 10, 15 grand a night, and everybody thinks that's a lot of money. But
you got to pay everybody out of that.
A tour bus, you got to pay commissions, you got to pay managers, you got to pay all this. You're walking home with 30% of your money, And
which then gets taxed.
Yeah, and then that doesn't last long either when you got, when you got your regular expenses as a human being. So, and you might not be working 100 dates a year. You might only be working 50, And that's what people forget about is, luckily country music has the most loyal fans. They never go away, which is amazing. And now Jason's crowds are the same ones and they just keep growing and now he's selling out arenas. And they gave... He lucked out and had the chance to build. We've had 21 singles, and people forget that.
21?
Yeah, it's been nuts. We're five albums. And
how many sucked out of that? How many tanked?
Two.
Two out of 21.
That's love that you asked, but also that he knew the answer.
Yeah, because obviously we'd know. I would know if somebody says how many stations.
Tell us which carried your show and fired you?
I can tell you exactly.
When you say tanked, Relentless died at 15,
which was a great song,
which sounded great.
I remember that was Patrick's favorite song for a year.
And 1994 got off the charts in 15 weeks. It was done. It was at 15 on the charts. The rest of them all went top 10 and five and number one. He's had 13 number ones. And the rest were top tens, but those two.
How many number ones have you had?
14. I had Thomas Rhett's It Goes Like This was my other number one. I've had a bunch of top fives, with Montgomery Gentry, Where I Come From, Trace Atkins, Just Fishing, things,
And does it work the same for you? Are you going to get, as a producer, do you get residuals and royalty checks for years on end, or is it just a one-time thing?
It depends on the type of song. Dirt Road Anthem, I'm still getting paid like it's a top 50 song, And some other ones you're not, Laughing Till You Cried, I don't think, you're not getting things for those early ballads or anything, but... Some of those trendsetters like She's Country, Dirt Road Anthem, Night Train is, pays great. Those things do because those are 100% kind of something Jason invented.
This is fascinating. Again, I'm Bubba. If you're listening right now, Big D is over there. Big D, say hello.
Hi.
People ask us all the time. I can't tell you guys apart. Michael Knox is a producer. Patrick is
over
there.
Wait till I get that
texting.
Voice transplant.
Watch
out. When I get that done, it's going to be huge.
So how did you get into we had you in because it's just cool. Normally we have random guests from airline pilot friends to astronauts, you name it. We pretty much throw everybody into this mix on the podcast. How did you get into it and say, I'm going to be, were you a singer? Were you a writer? You said, one day I'm going to be a record producer.
Well, all through high school, I found out who my dad was when I was 12, 13 years old and found out he was an old 50s artist. And I was I knew he was in the music business. I went on the road with him. I knew he played shows. I just didn't know the impact. And he was the first guy to ever write and sing his own number one hit in the history of rock and roll, which was a song called Party Doll. And so I started getting caught up in that when I was about 12, 13. And then come my senior year in high school, I bought a little cassette 4-track.
You're kind of like Tim McGraw.
I don't know.
You'd realize, no, but I'm saying you're kind of like Tim because he found out who his dad was and then he got into baseball.
Yeah, yeah. But I knew who my dad was. I just didn't know what he did and I didn't know the, you're a kid, man. You don't know what this means, you know. Yeah. And he invented Tex-Mex, which was, you know, rockabilly, you know, which was great. So,
I thought you meant the food.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, he did. He invented Tex-Mex.
That makes him the greatest American ever.
He ate a lot of Tex-Mex, you know. So I got caught up in four-track cassette things in high school, and then it moved into in my dorms and getting kicked out of college dorms and apartments recording. And it kind of – I always wanted to be a singer, and I was horrible. So I started finding people to record, and it kind of evolved from there. And then I love songs, so I got caught up in that. And I graduated college with an advertising marketing degree, and nobody would hire me. So I started a little thing called Hit Pluggers, which was a song plugging company back in 91.
Explain song plugging for somebody.
That's where, like, a songwriter will give me their songs they've written, and I'll try to get them cut. You know, I'll go to A&R, or I'll go to producers or musicians, anybody, and get them to hear the songs and see if we can get them to the artist. Okay. So I had 10 cuts my first year and won number one. It's Your Call with Bruce Birch, my old mentor, and taught me how to plug songs. And then Warner Chappell hired me, which was Gary Overton at the time. And he brought me into Warner Chappell in 92. And I was vice president there for 10 years and signed Gretchen Wilson, John Rich, and Jason Aldean, and signed all these writers that I'm real proud of, from Vicky McGehee to Rodney Clausen's, you know, co-venture. I brought them in, and, you know, a lot of things. It was just, you know, it was a lot of years there. So we had a lot of fun. And then they sold the company, got fired, and moved to Pure Music just 4 years ago. And now I'm running their company.
You have a cool story.
But producing came through going in the room with the writers and learning how to make demos and learning how to cut a song that an A&R person would enjoy to hear and take it to the artist, you know. So Jeff Stevens was one of my writers. And, you know, he produces, Luke Bryan, you know. So I had all those. I was Jeff Stevens' song plugger and had him all those George Strait cuts, Carried Away, Carrying Your Love With Me, True, you know, with him and Marv Green. And those were all my guys, man. Those were all
when
my
you
writers.
Know a really good song, like, because there's a lot of people like to write songs and, you know, Patrick likes to write songs.
You don't judge it if it's really good. You just judge it if you like it or not. And I know if I like something really quick, you know, you can just tell by the feel of it. It's not about, is the song any good? It's like, does it, you know, I hope people pay me for my opinion, so I'm trying to give it to them 100%.
Here's one I'll explain. This is a radio thing, totally a radio thing. The intro part of the song is like the first, you know, 9 seconds or whatever a song is before they start singing. That in radio term is called the intro, and we get to talk that up and do our DJ thing. And if an intro sucks, we don't like the song.
Yeah.
I know it sounds crazy, but like, here's one, American Kids, Kenny Chesney. The first time I heard the song, I caught it in the middle and I'm like, you know, I don't know if I like it or not. And then I came to work and I played the song and that intro, that, you know, that little thing, I was like, my new favorite song. Yeah. It's weird how that little part of a song can establish something like a feeling inside of you.
Well, first impression's dangerous.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's the same thing. How many times do we have an album at home that we pick up and you have a song in there that you hate because for some reason you heard it at the wrong time, that first impression, it just didn't come off right, and then you end up loving it later.
Or if you hear a cover song before you ever hear the original, and then it doesn't sound right, and you're like, well, no, I like that one better. You tend to like your, you know, if you liked the original, you tend to like it better than the cover, or if you didn't like it, sometimes the cover, you go, hey, that's pretty good.
Unless it's a punk cover. You put on some Me First and the Gimme Gimmes, Sunday Morning
Bubba,
Coming Down.
Bubba has two things. One, it's punk covers of like pop songs and things that you wouldn't expect. The other
and
is
country,
bluegrass dude. Covers of random pop songs.
Yeah, but you're still judging them toward how good you enjoy the original.
Yeah.
You know?
See, I have two meters. I have I personally love this, and I think this is a huge hit. Like, I can hear the difference in my head.
Not me.
And sometimes I feel bad for artists or when I really, really personally love a song. Because I know that it's not necessarily going to be mass appeal type stuff.
Yeah, it's tough, man. As a song plugger, you know, when I was pitching songs, you know, you're trying to put certain songs with certain artists, but you don't genuinely know what they want to say on a record, or they don't, or what they, how they want to approach their album and stuff. So you're trying to. I was a huge radio fan. I mean, I had probably 700-800 CDs, and probably 500 of them were greatest hits. You know, I was a huge radio fan and loved singles, loved everything. You know, from you know, my dad to Buddy Holly to Roy Orbison, all the way to the Bee Gees to, you know, Neil Sedaka all the way to the, you know, to Kiss, to heavy metal, to Motley Crue, all the way to Jason.
Pretty much like everybody.
Yeah, yeah. And my iPod is 10 days of music, you know, and it's crazy. So I was a huge radio fan, so it helped me out with putting songs, you know, together. So when I really, really liked something, it was usually something pretty cool and commercial. But it also fit, you know, it also fit the artist.
What about, you know, let's kind of go back to that. You know, you're talking about your influences, the stuff you love and all that. How hard is it to not go in a certain direction whenever you're doing, like, let's say a Jason album? You know, She's Country had that crunchy guitar sound. Did you ever dial it back, or did you say, no, let's crank this up?
Yeah. No, we never dialed it back because, you know, the thing you're trying to do, and great, the guys I work with in the studio always help motivate that with me, is you're trying to be as genuine as you can to the song, because the fans know, man, when you're holding back. The fans know when something's not 100% there, and you can tell with songs that kind of get in the 30s and they go away. You know, there's something there that's just missing, and it's a commitment. It's something, you know. And so we always go for it. That's why the guitars are very dangerous.
You ever have somebody step into the studio and you go, there's nothing I could do with this voice?
Yeah,
I mean, you don't have to say names.
Yeah, no, I usually that's why you don't see me producing a lot of people like some other producers, you know, might do. I got to love what they do, you know, and that's why I usually might not produce a whole record. I might just do a few songs on them. And I usually get to A&R a lot of what I do, which is
and
great.
And explain A&R to people.
That means I usually get to kind of help look for the songs and be a big part of that part of it and putting them together. Because I did a project, no names mentioned, one time where it was all just, hey, just do this, and just give it to us. And, man, I left there just feeling so unsatisfied, you know. And I remember that.
So they didn't let you put yourself into it?
Well, they had already had everything and just said, go cut it. Oh. It was very unsatisfying as a producer, you know. It just wasn't any fun, you know. And I would rather work with you know, something that I really got to be there and develop and be a part of, you know, than to just kind of get, you know. And there were, you know, there were hit songs on there, and I just really you just didn't get to enjoy it like you would if you kind of put it together.
People send us so much stuff all the time. They'll send us tweets with their clip on YouTube or whatever, and I can't listen to everything because there's just not enough time in the day. I don't know how you do it.
Yeah, we went like with Jason, we went through about 5,000 songs for the new record.
5,000 whittled down to what, 12, 13?
Yeah, we had ended up with 15 on the record.
Okay, but still, 5,000 down to 15.
My job is I go through all these songs, and I make sure Jason don't hear, you know, more than 30, you know, so he's not just, you know, kind of, you know.
So he really trusts you with your song selection.
Well, we grew up in it together, man. I mean, when I first worked with him, it was 16 years ago. You got to remember, he was 20, early 20s.
Yeah.
And, you know, 21. And, you know, so we kind of grew in his sound together. So we kind of know, you know, there, we might be off two songs tops, you know, and the rest of it, we just kind of look at each other and know.
How many do you cut? Okay, so you got 15 that you say made the album. How many do you cut to get to that point? I mean, I know you say you bring, you, really? So
yeah.
You bring him 30, he picks the 15, and that's all you cut? You don't do like any bonuses to go, well, maybe let's hear it once it's done.
Yeah, we've only overcut once, and those songs are still just kind of sitting
there.
You
guys should do that, because what if something happens and, Jason doesn't record anymore? Then, like, you say, okay, well, look, hey, here's a hidden album of stuff that we found, the stuff in the vault.
Well, there's a catch to that. You the level of songs we get are really strong. I mean, our album cuts are some artists' singles, you know what I mean? And they're
right.
Really strong. And you would hate to get that great song from one of your friends or a writer, and then it just sits there on a kind of a the table, you know, and it kind of ruins it, because then people are afraid to cut it because Jason might put it out one day. And, you know, so it's kind of this thing where you're kind of like, it's a little unfair. And Jason is not a big overcutter anyway. He loves to just do what he needs to do, and that's it.
I remember the moment I realized he was a huge star, because I met Jason Aldean 10 years ago at the country radio seminar. And my first thought, and I really can't believe I'm going to say this in public, quote unquote, is
he's hot.
No, my first thought was, nice guy. Well, that's a terrible name. Because I thought it was his real name. Like, that's not even his real name.
Well, it is.
It's his middle name. Yeah, but, I thought.
Jason? You don't like Jason or Aldean?
Aldean. I didn't think that was a good name for
Aldean
a country singer.
Aldean is his middle name?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Jason Aldean something something?
Yeah.
William. So Aldean is somebody's first name somewhere.
No, it's his middle name.
What do you mean? No, but I'm saying if it's his middle name, usually that's what you get. It's like, you know,
No, or it's a family name or whatever. But it's still, it was, I just remember thinking, well, they could have given him a better name. Like, you know, but then that's all I thought. But
damn,
he seemed like
damn
you know,
parents.
Yeah.
I don't think Jason out. I don't know. Maybe I'm just so used to it now. I don't think it's a bad
You're
name.
Right. Now, but that's one of the things. Like, my, you know, now you hear it and you go, well, yeah, that's great. I just remember very vividly that was my first thought.
Now, there and are then, some that have horrible names.
Jason Allen Dean. That's a bad one.
No, what's the group? It's a group that came in. They're like called, it's called the Hutchinsons.
Oh, the Henningsons.
Great people. I love them.
Oh, Salt of the Earth.
Horrible name.
Yeah. Call yourself something else.
Yes, Henningsons.
It's hard to say.
It sounds like a name that Fletch would come up with in a movie.
William Henningsen.
Four people got that.
John Henningsen.
That's okay, but the four people that got it, they loved that joke.
You know, I don't think I even remember Fletch. I watched it when I was such a small kid.
The second one was.
I didn't get it. The jokes were way over my head because I was that dumb kid.
Hennings, that was bad. And then you get like, who's a guy who has. There's like other people whose names. Rodney. You had Rodney. You've
Atkins.
Got Atkins. You've got
Trace Atkins.
Trace Atkins.
You Rhett have Akins.
Rhett Akins. That whole menage a trois is awful.
Oh, God, I saw it in my head. Oh, no.
I mean, I remember going, all right, this boy. Is well, we had Rhett was in, and I was going.
We were making fun of it.
I kind of messed up once, and we all laughed because they thought I was being funny. But I know I really screwed it up. And they're like, oh, I see what you did there. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's what I did. But
Rhett's such a cool dude, though.
I like Rhett a lot.
Oh, that's a.
You ever work with Rhett? I know you said you worked with Thomas.
I cut his songs, you know, but I've known Rhett.
When
she
said baby was Rhett Akins.
Yeah, and he's had other ones, too. I used to pitch him songs when he was an artist. One of his last singles was one of my cuts as a song plugger. One of his ballads, one of his last ballads in the late 90s or whatever. Yeah, but Rhett and I go back a long time. And then his son, I got to produce his, you know, a couple things on his son, which was amazing because Rhett would come by and, you know, and it'd be me and Rhett, you know, talking, and then his son would be in the other room.
It's funny. We get talking to Rhett, and everything goes back to hair bands. For some reason, whenever we get around him, we're like totally talking, you know, Warrant and Guns N' Roses and just dumb stuff from that era.
He's a huge Jessica White fan, too.
Really?
Yeah, the Dancing Outlaw. He even went to the guy's house and hung out with him one time.
With who?
Knew?
Who's this?
The Dancing Outlaw, Jessica White. Yeah, it was
Jessica
a big
one. Yeah.
Just Google it.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's
why do I feel like the only uncool kid in here all of a sudden? Well, it's not easy. I can't imagine being in a room and going, well, we kind of do it. We kind of have your experience when we have artists come in here, especially new artists, and they're going to play something for us. And they'll come in here and in between breaks, we'll let them kind of do a little, you know, plug the instruments in, you know, kind of do a little sound check, nothing crazy. And then they get in, and I always think, because the other day we had somebody in, and I was kind of rushing them through. I was kind of like, okay, and I can hear they're going to play now, go ahead. And I was driving home that day thinking about it, and I was like, you know what, shame on me. That's an awful position to be in. Yep. To go in, here you're going to walk in on a major radio show and
even ours.
And then come to ours. and you're going to play to us who are sterile and we're just with our arms crossed and looking at you.
I don't even get to look at him because I'm over here listening to the mix.
And he's so short.
And thank you.
You know what you need? You need those rounded mirrors.
The mirrors on the ceiling.
Yeah, like, where you can kind of see like for oncoming traffic.
Yes.
Or like they put them in the corner of like a grocery store.
Yeah. Or just mirror the walls.
Yes.
Yeah. The hardest thing is an artist going on the road doing a radio tour, you know, because it's so, you know, the radio guys don't know them. It's real impersonal. you know, and they got to sell them on something at 8 o'clock in the morning when this act might be normally singing at 10:30 at night.
Not normally, always.
And it's tough, man. You know, Jason was a freak of nature because he sings the same all the time. I mean, when we're doing vocals, he just sings top to bottom 6 times and then I edit it. I mean, it's that simple. You know, he's. But we don't really record anything challenging for him.
Does he ever surprise you, though, sometimes? And you go, well, I did not expect him to do that. I've known him for this long, and he just did that. That's crazy.
Well, I mean, when he did Dirt Road Anthem, what you're hearing, the rap thing, is a one take. That's his first That's his first take.
I remember when that first, because that wasn't even a single when we got the album in our hands.
Yeah.
And I was asking him about it, and he was embarrassed. He was like, yeah, I don't, I did not want to rap.
Nobody knew how it was going to go. Like, it was either going to be huge or
terrible. Well, that's what I said. I said, is it going to be a single at the time? I remember we were talking about it. He goes, yeah, I'm sure it will be. And,
that was kind of the first, little rap thing to kind of hit the mainstream?
Convoy.
Yeah, Alan Jackson did, besides did Convoy? Something, but his was more talking. And
the I'll Go On Loving You.
Yeah.
I love that song. And that's weird because, again, a lot of people, that's a very polarizing song.
Yeah.
But I like it.
Yeah.
Which one's this?
I'll Go On Loving You, the one where he's sitting there going, the soft roses and da-da. You know.
Yeah.
I know you weren't a big fan of that one.
But the way Jason approached that, I mean, he did more of a, he swaggered instead of rapped it. You know, and that's why I kept the first take, because he wasn't thinking about it. He was just kind of going through it and doing it Jason's way. And then when they start thinking about it, they can mess it up.
Did he know the Colt Ford version of it first?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we
because it doesn't sound like it. Now, I mean, well, that as a compliment.
We had it for the Wide Open record. We just didn't cut it then. You know, we had that and My Kind of Party.
It was too early, wasn't it?
Well, it just other things were fitting the record better at that time. You know, and he was, and after She's Country, we could take that chance. You know, when She's Country hit, you were like, well, this is like, Errol Smith, you know,
Walk This
Rum DMC right here. So we can go one more place. You know, and Jason's what makes it country. It's not. That's what people get caught up in. They forget that the artist has to be a country artist to make that work. You know, it's not like, you know, we got all these really cool drum loops and stuff going on, but if you don't have a real country artist, you can't sell it to the format because it's still small town America, you know.
That's right.
It's weird, and there's such a weird backlash on it. I had a friend of mine, and I'm going to read her post right now. Dude, this is crazy. It's a friend of mine that I play softball with. And she's like, I'm so excited. She was listening to us do Throwback Thursday. And she posted this from yesterday. She says, I'm so excited. These guys are playing my kind of country music. I love that. And not the bro country crap of today. Happy, happy, happy. And there's such a backlash against bro country. And I hate throwing the Dirt Road Anthem in there. But it really was the song that allowed everybody else to take it to the next level.
You eliminate Jason and you don't have...
Florida Georgia Line.
Eric Church, the way he is, because he toured with Jason a year and a half. You know, Luke Bryan, a year and a half. You know, Jason opened the doors to these guys to such a, 20, 25,000 people a night instead of their usual 3,000 that they were doing in the clubs. And then Brantley Gilbert, then Colt Ford, then Florida Georgia Line, then, you know, but you got to remember, Jason's not bro country. You know, it's kind of like, when Big and Rich and them came out, they opened the door. Jason just kind of kicked it down a little
bit. I forget that Save a Horse was before Jason.
Yeah. I mean, and that opened the door to make us go, hey, man, Hicktown can work. You know, because I'd signed John, when I was working over there. And all those songs are on Jason's first record were 4 years old.
Yeah.
Those things were 4 years old.
Okay. Now, wait a minute. Let's we're going to take this back a little further. Let's talk about the John Rich and Big Kenny. That was, first of all, that was so different back then. I mean, that was 10 years ago. And for these guys to be sitting there, they were rapping. They had Cowboy Troy. They had everything going on. There was that 10 years ago.
Two-foot Fred.
Yeah. There was so much going on there. I mean, you as like an artist development guy and all that kind of thing at the time, that took a leap for you to go, okay, this could work.
Well, the biggest leap I had to take was just to get out of the way. You know, because the normal Nashville way is to get in the way and tame it down. And the hardest thing is to stay out of the way and let these guys be artists. You know, let them be kind of what they are. Because, I it would be hard to believe somebody sat in a room with Kris Kristofferson and critiqued his songs.
But they did.
It would be hard to,
But they did.
Yeah, well, they might have.
They might have.
But I'm telling you, after meeting these guys and knowing them, nobody told them what to do if they didn't want to do it.
Well, I was going to say that somebody told Kris Kristofferson something, and he went, well, and
having somebody there that's critiquing and you're trusting them and you have a relationship with them, you know, sitting in a room with an artist is a lot different than somebody saying, hey, man, you're going to sing this.
Yeah.
That's right. A whole different deal. Having a partner in there that you can kind of play songs to and they critique it is a little different than somebody saying, hey, man, this is wrong, fix it. You know, I just don't see the Waylons and Willies and all them just saying, yeah, I'm going to do whatever you want me to do. And John and them had that. John and them were very, we're going to do it our way. You need to embrace it or not. Now,
right.
Now, you know, was it always going to be a longevity kind of thing? You know, you never looked at it as something like that, but you looked at it as something that was going to explode.
You didn't know how long, whenever that came on, you didn't think, okay, this is going to, because they were like,
Well, Save a Horse died in the 20s.
Yeah.
No, and it got still to the top 10 on airplay. Well, I know because it won me a bet.
Well, it shows 25, I believe, on Billboard, right?
Yeah. Here's the thing. That song still, that is still a record we play,
yeah.
You know, because it quote-unquote tests well, we say. People love it. But
Save a Horse?
Save a Horse. Listen to that record. Looking back now, it's been 10 years, and you're a producer. That's exactly what happened with that record because they had Paul Worley produce that record, and Paul Worley's like a legendary producer and is known for being kind of a traditional country guy. And then he got in there and just kind of went, "I'm going to make this sound good, but you guys are going to have to."
Yeah. Well, Paul kind of stayed out of the way.
Yeah, I mean,
these guys,
out of the way.
John and them have a very focused vision of what they wanted.
Trust me.
You know, so and that first album I think was a good door opener to this new country.
You know, and I got a copy of it still holds up.
If you listen to Horse of a Different Color today, it sounds fresh.
Yeah.
It sounds like you kind of get away from it every so often, and
it's good.
You get away from it and you go, oh, okay, yeah, no, I've heard it. But if you separate, like now it's been 10 years and listen to it, that whole record is amazing.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool directions going on there. You know, it's hard to keep doing that sometimes, you know, but John was a great writer. I mean, Jason's first four singles were songs that I had kind of hid at the publishing company for Jason in case he got a deal. You know, the Hicktown, Why, Amarillo Sky, and Johnny Cash were all things that were four or five years old that I had hid for Jason in case we got a deal.
John wrote those?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Somebody else cut Why. Who cut Why?
Brown.
Shannon Brown. Yeah. Shannon Brown.
Oh, trust me.
From a woman's perspective.
There were a lot of people pitching.
Shannon Brown, the girl from the calendar?
Yes, Big D loves Shannon Brown.
We all do. Shannon Brown
is Big D's Kelly Pickler for me.
I followed her on Instagram and
started talking about it on the air.
And I was like giving it out, you know, because she's not, it's not Shannon. It's like some other weird thing. To find her.
He's like, oh, this is my favorite Instagram account to follow now.
And then she shut it.
She blocked everyone.
No.
Are you still on it?
I can pull it up right now. I can message her now if I wanted. If I wanted. She's married to Silva, what's his face.
Yeah. She's a very beautiful man.
She's like, if you want to try to get as close as you can to Jennifer Aniston, you talk to Shannon Brown.
Yeah.
You know, she looks a lot like her.
I remember I was, we were talking to her out front of
one of the hotels.
Yeah. We're waiting on a car from valet. And
it's not just that she's pretty, it's that she's so likable.
Yeah. She's really nice. I mean, anyway.
Which is part of my Kelly thing. I love Kelly Pickler just because she's one of those people you could talk to all day.
Yeah.
And so she's talking to some fan who kind of wasn't all there. This woman was kind of, she was a little off the wall. And it was just the two of them talking, and I could tell just body language that Shannon was.
It had gotten to a point
she was done. You know, she was done. And so I walk over and kind of inserted myself into the conversation and actually put my body in between this freaky woman and Shannon Brown. And she was sitting there, and I'm talking, you know, and she's whispering. She mouths, thank you to me. So she pretty much owes me.
And that lady's listening to this right now. I remember that.
When Big D stood between me and
there was this big, giant white guy stood in front of me and Shannon.
He was so rude.
I hate him.
He cast this giant shadow and blocked out the sun.
I hate him.
So who is doing some work that you like? Like, I know you mentioned Eric Church. I love Eric Church, and I always have. I mean, going back to, what was the album before Carolina with pink line, two pink lines and all that on. He's always had his own sound, yeah. which I think is why I really enjoy his albums when they come out. Who's some of the other people that you think are just doing some really cool stuff?
You know, I mean, it's you know, with me, it's more just guys that that you can say, hey, man, I can sit through this. You know, I did like
some, I can sit through yeah, this. Yeah, like yeah, I can, well, my ears don't bleed.
Yeah, kind of? My ears don't. No, but it's more like, you know, I look at whole projects more than I do single songs. You know, so if I hear a single song, I'll like the song or whatever. But I gotta like the whole artist, which is why I like an Eric Church. You know, Jay Joyce is a different kind of producer, and he comes about it. It works great for him. I don't know if it works great for some of the other people he's doing, in my opinion, but I love what he does with Eric Church.
You know what sounds silly is I like the way they mic the drums for Eric Church, and it's such a small little nuance, but it's just cool sounding yeah. the way they do it.
Yeah, and it's funny, if you listen to them back to back with other records, I mean, it's about a third of, I mean, it's about half volume, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not, it's like my stuff, it's more analog, you know, we cut it, we jump it to 2-inch and yeah. everything, and you know, so it's a whole different approach, and those volumes are a lot lower. So that might be why I like a lot of Eric's stuff. Like when we did The Only Way I Know, man, and I got to hang with Eric, you know, Eric and Luke Bryan. Those guys are really, they're really artists. You know, you might not like what they do, but they're genuinely artists at what they do. I mean,
how hard is it, and have you ever put a backward message on a recording? Honestly,
it'd be simple, but we've never done that. No.
You should.
Why would you not do it?
You should stop. Look, what do you have? You just turned in the...
Well, wonder if they like misunderstood it, you know, and it wasn't what I put on there.
We had that.
That's part of it.
On the show, we were doing this big party out in the parking lot, which, by the way, you stopped by for.
Oh, my
Somebody
goodness.
Says, in the middle, they say, photobomb!
Yeah, DJ Silver yelled out, photo, and he said it like this, photobomb.
Well, somebody...
And somebody heard...
Yeah, blank yeah. Obama.
Yeah.
Obama.
And there was all this drama. We had to go and find the archives, the tapes, and say, he says photobomb. We had to isolate
and
it and do all kinds
of... And you can hear it. I mean, it's just clear. But if someone listening passively,
yeah.
kind of
yeah,
in the background
yeah,
hears,
you can see that.
Photobomb.
I get in enough trouble having my own opinion they can understand. I don't have to do
a
hidden message.
Mask.
Yes. Dude, if
it would be cool. I would think, though, as a music fan, I think it would be cool to throw something in there.
I would. I totally would.
Do you remember when we did the subliminal message? We would tell people, and coming up now is a subliminal message, and you hear, and hidden in the subliminal message is, Big D and Bubba aren't fat, they're sexy. You know, just like little dumb things, like, but you couldn't hear it regularly. It was all out of phase and everything, so you really couldn't hear it, but your brain processes it.
Then you'd go out that night, and all these girls are looking at y'all, and you don't know, you know, hey.
Hey there.
I'm pretty sure none of that works.
Yeah.
It's still great. We
ever since the Beatles lied, Paul was not dead. The messages don't work.
Who's the other one that was back mask? Was it Kiss? No.
Ozzy. Supposedly.
All those people back then did it. You ever, like, remember that Prince thing where it was like, tap, 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 then you listen to that backwards? I remember that was the first thing I did whenever that album came out. I went and I put it on reel-to-reel tape and I flipped it around. And he's sitting there saying, praise Jesus, and all that kind of stuff.
Well,
really?
Well, we lost the magic now because we have CDs and you can't play them backwards.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, you kind of lose that.
Though,
you lose the thing where you spin it. You know?
If you import it into your hard drive, pull it up in your thing, you could do it.
This is more convoluted than someone sitting there playing their records backwards by hand, which was also, who does that?
I used to do it. You remember, you get the honeycomb box and they'd put the record on the back. And
yes!
you cut that record off.
That's
and put it
right.
on there, and you'd spin it backwards and go, what are they saying? You know, and it was all Halloween stuff. You know, it was great.
And it was real flimsy.
Yeah.
And it was, mine was, I got a red one, I remember. It was colored. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, how can they, this is progress for mankind. Look at this. There is a piece of plastic on my cereal box
that I can play,
and it has... Not bad, horrible quality.
Yeah.
And
you played it on your Fisher Price record player,
and you can play it.
Yeah, I used to get the Army men. You know, you'd order them off the back of the cereal box, and you couldn't even stand them up. You know, you'd get them. This is the worst Army men I ever got.
Oh, I never ordered them.
Those were the ones who would always be the dead guys. When I was playing, these are the guys that I would put on top of the dirt that I would bury the M80 underneath. And I would blow stuff
for the
up.
Guy who was always the dead guy, I always use a guy who was like he was crawling under on his flat. You
he
know,
had
like
the gun
prone.
In one hand.
Yeah, and he's like, kind of doing this kind of back and forth motion. He was always my dead guy.
Well, that's funny. I mean, because technology and things have changed so much. You know, I'm working with kids that are 20 years old now that are amazing, even getting Aldean cuts and everything. And they're and 20 years ago, I mean, that's the 90s. I mean, these guys were born, you know, before I, you know. I mean,
CDs.
They don't
have
even know
here.
What a cassette is.
How is? I mean, is the future look pretty good? I mean, we don't have knuckleheads coming up.
I think everything's cool. You know, right now we're in that Haddock phase. You know, that we had of the '90s, where everything's starting to sound the same. You know, and if you remember that in the late '90s, you know, we couldn't tell the country artist apart. You know, they were all the cool Haddock, and they were all sounding the same, and you couldn't tell them apart. And we're kind of getting there right now.
You know what the problem is? It's everybody's cutting the same songs from the same writers.
Yeah. Well, it isn't that as much as they're using the same mid-tempo drum loop, you know. And if you look at it, we got a lot of mids. We got a lot of mids in our format, and it's because we have loop guys that are writing. And no offense, I mean, they're amazing songs. There's some really cool things going on. But when everybody does it, it's kind of like having one producer produce every song in the format.
Is that what it is? Maybe it's not the writer thing. Maybe it is the production end.
It's a combination. I mean, we've always had the same a group of writers who get hot at one time.
That's true, because in the 90s it was Skip Ewing.
Yeah, I mean, there's always been guys that are this way. Yeah. Jeffrey Steele in the early part of the last decade. Yeah. You know, every song was a Jeffrey Steele song, but they didn't all sound exactly the same. Because a Jeffrey Steele song by Rascal Flatts and a Jeffrey Steele song by Montgomery Gentry do not sound at all alike.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're kind of someone who knows writing, songwriting, you don't realize the same guy wrote both of those. But you can hear songs on the radio now and go, yeah, I can tell Ashley Gourley wrote
all three of these records. Getting songs, you'd be amazed at how many of the identical type subjects I would get. You know, just,
oh my goodness.
And there's, you know, and when you're writing to loops, a lot of times you don't pay attention to your chords, so that's why they sound the same, because you're writing to something that's really helping you out probably more than it needs to. So you're not really thinking your way out of the box.
Well, it's not that we don't have up tempo, because there's a couple up tempo songs.
Yeah,
but it's like as a format we got afraid of slow songs.
Yeah.
So we have slow songs with a mid-level drum beat to mask the fact that it's a slow song. My favorite example is Cop Car by Keith Urban,
which
is a great song, but it's a slow song, and there's nothing wrong with that. But then it has this mid-level drum beat in the middle to kind of hide the fact that it's a ballad.
That song is about the same tempo as Stupid Boy, but it doesn't feel it because of the drum beat.
Yeah.
Play It Again by Luke Bryan's the same way. That's a slow song, but you've got a mid-tempo drum beat in it to hide that. Because we don't want to play slow songs, apparently.
Yeah, there's not many artists that I've been very lucky. I know I keep harping on him, but I'm very lucky with Jason, who's a very...
Can you say his name again, and I'll put some echo behind it?
Yeah, Jason Aldean.
Okay.
I'm very lucky to work with a guy who can do a lot of different things. I mean, you got to remember, he does a She's Country, and then he does a Big Green Tractor, and then he does a Don't You Want to Stay, and then he does a Dirt Road Anthem, and then he does Night Train.
Mixing it up
is a good thing. There is no other artist in our format that can do those types of things, and it's still believable back-to-back.
Well, because they still sound like Jason Aldean songs.
Well, because he's Jason Aldean.
Yeah.
It's not I'm not Jason Aldean. You know, he's the one bringing the mojo to the table. All I'm doing is trying not to screw it up and making it sound like Jason, you know. And that's the problem that a producer has the most, is you got to remember when you walk in the room, it ain't my record, it's Jason's record, and I got to make it sound like Jason sounds. And some people have trouble with that when you're not using we did use some loops in Jason's new record, but then we also got these huge power ballads that are amazing, you know, and then we got these really cool earthy kind of tracks. So it really goes a lot of different places.
Shannon Bryan can do that too.
It's hard for young artists though, because like I have a friend who's a new artist at a major label, but you know, he wants to sound one way, his producer wants him to sound another way, and his manager both, and then the guys at the record label want him to sound another way.
Yeah, well then and he so needs to not have a record deal.
Who decides how he dresses though?
Kind of, you know.
Yeah. No, and when I say he needs not have that record deal with them is because they're not getting him. He should be very cautious about that, because I mean, you know.
And it's friendly. It's yeah. not, you know, a no, do this or else kind of thing. Yeah, but yeah. everybody kind of feels he's capable of all three styles. So it's difficult. Like you said with Jason, he can do it all. But what does he want to do? Yeah. What is he going to, you know. Yeah. Not everybody wants to do a record that has, or maybe you put all those songs on the record, but they don't want that to be yeah. the single.
Well, we've had incredible singers in our format that can sing the phone book and sound amazing, and they're not stars because they can't. They can't focus on something that sets them apart of everybody else, you know.
Well, yeah,
and you know,
people like that. We were talking off the air about Chris Stapleton being the best singer I've ever heard.
Patrick was talking about that. Patrick is the biggest Chris Stapleton fan
on
the planet.
Well, Chris is. When we cut a Chris song, it's dangerous because you're not going to beat the vocal. I don't care who you are. You know, Chris is a freak of nature. And, we cut one of his on Jason's new record, and I remember Jason going, man,
how am I supposed to do this?
Can he come and sing on this with me?
And did he?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow,
I mean,
nice.
and he goes, I'll feel a lot better if he's there with me, you know, because mm-hmm. Chris and Luke Bryan did it.
Luke Bryan did
you
it,
know,
too, and had a huge hit, Drink some, a Beer. You can hear Chris Stapleton in the background.
Some guys are just artists that you don't ever get to enjoy in the mainstream. You know, they're just great friggin' artists.
I think we should go ahead and send people to your site. If you want to learn more about Michael and want to check him out, you want to do just hop online and go to Music Knox, as in KNOX, musicknox.com. You can find out all about him. Production. Do you? I know you're on Twitter too, but is it also Music Knox?
I believe so. The girl that runs my day-to-day, Shalacy Griffin, she handles my Twitter and Instagram. So it's I'm old, but now I look very young sometimes.
You don't do your own Twitter?
No,
lame.
Hey.
You got a flip phone?
God! Oh, dude, my God!
He has a, what is that, a Nokia or a Motorola?
This is an accessory, too, you know.
Oh, it's a flip phone.
Yes, I have
that is my dad's phone, dude.
And just so everybody who can't see anything, they asked me if I did Twitter, and I pulled out my flip phone, and they understood why I don't do Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah, you're the guy that has to write RT and then whatever.
I'm the guy that's got to push the three times to get to the F. So to cuss you out on my phone, it's really actually like 22 buttons.
Good thing you know your way around a studio over a phone.
Yeah, I mean, now you know what? I'm the other guy now. I'm like, if I had the iPhones, if I had that, I never would work. I would be too accessible. They would be getting in touch. I'd be sitting on my phone all friggin' day.
When I need to do stuff, I like when we walk into the studio in the morning, I plug my phone in and put it on the charger, and it's about 4 feet away from me the entire show. I never look at it.
Yeah, see, I'm a video game nut. I'm an ADD guy.
What are you playing right now?
I backed off of it all because it's consumed you, man. You know, I'm an ADD guy, man. I get caught up in it.
So. I got there's this game called
Angry Birds.
War Thunder on my PlayStation 4. Awesome.
No, he said Angry Birds.
I know, I heard.
Angry Birds are dangerous, you know.
Wow. Keep them away from Flappy Bird.
Hey, what year are you in?
I'm wearing cargos.
I guess so this new game called
Tetris.
I think
I'm in the 90s. So.
Got this new game called Tetris we'll introduce you to.
Asteroids.
Missile Command.
Yeah. It had the ball, you know.
Yeah.
Come on.
Oh, yeah. I love all those games.
I am a huge throwback guy, guys. I'm a big 80s dude. I love the 50s. I love disco. I love the 50s era. And I'm a huge throwback guy, so I get caught up in all that stuff.
You know what I listen to a lot, and people are like, I thought you were a country guy. I love old soul music, man. Yeah. I mean, I love that
stuff.
Well,
that is country. You know, I mean, Ray Charles, all that stuff, you know. And so, I mean, because I work for Pure Music, and a lot of our stuff is Ralph Peer. I mean, the very first country copyrights were the Carter family, which is Pure Music. And Man of Constant Sorrow, Pure Music. You Are My Sunshine, Pure Music. I mean, all that stuff back in, you know, the Cup song from the movie Pitch Perfect?
Yeah.
That was an old bluegrass song from 1927.
Was it really?
And people don't know that.
Who did it originally?
The Carter family.
Okay, I'm going to tell my daughter. She'll sit there on the floor. The Cup song. She'll sit on the floor with the cups. And
you're going to miss me when I'm gone. You're going to miss me when I'm gone, when I'm gone. It's an old bluegrass song.
Now
if you
Big
hear
Big D doesn't know the Cup song. Wow. Yeah.
Pitch Perfect, the movie.
He doesn't have daughters.
Oh, maybe
that's why
maybe
he
that's
doesn't
it.
Know.
That's
yes.
true.
I have two daughters.
That is a girl thing.
Yes, I had two daughters, and I knew that song very well.
Wow. They made a movie about the cup.
No, they made a movie.
It's just a scene in the movie, but then it became a viral hit.
Yeah, it was like 2 million sales, you know.
Wow. They didn't buy one. I can get one.
All right. I'm going to totally check that. My daughters will be freaked because I make them listen to like bluegrass. We'll be rolling in the Jeep or whatever. And they're like, oh, God, Dad, can you put it on my channel? I'm like, nope. You know, I'm going to have them doing all that. So I'm going to totally introduce them to the original Cup song. They're going to be just blown away.
Yeah, it's on YouTube. You can find. You can hunt it down.
Well, dude, it's good to see you. Thanks for coming in. You can follow him again, musicknox.com. You can send a tweet to the girl who runs his business at musicknox.
By the way, big shout out to Shalacy. She's awesome. Hi, and congratulations on the pregnancy.
Her name is Shalacy?
Yeah, she's from Louisiana. Shalacy Griffin.
Woo!
Shalacy.
Yeah. Yeah, she's,
does she know the Henningsons?
She's pregnant. She's pregnant, 8 months pregnant, so I'm going to miss her for a while.
All right. I got to get this out here, too. Once again, did you know it took 39 versions to make the American flag just right? It just goes to show you that things actually get better. Great things get better when they're reinvented. Valvoline's been reinventing motor oil ever since they introduced it to the world in 1866. They there, man. They've been there for a long time. And as the only American-owned motor oil company, we think it's about time to celebrate the legacy of America. So for a limited time, you can get a free American flag. And who doesn't want a free flag when you buy 5 quarts of Valvoline motor oil at a participating retailer? Stars and Stripes, we salute you with our hands on our hearts and our feet on the pedal. That's right, both feet. Valvoline.
You drive with both feet?
I do. I do sometimes, actually. You don't? You never do that? Or sometimes I will drive with my left foot because you never know when you're going to have an injury to your right. So you got to practice.
Stick shift, I had 2 feet. But just stay.
You should try.
Okay.
Valvoline, a little heel and toe. Valvoline, 140 years under the hood. Go to valvoline-usa.com for more information. What, Patrick?
Nothing.
You pulled the microphone up like you were going
to
add something.
I have
like,
nothing to add to that.
You ever drive with 2 feet?
No, I've never
Michael,
driven
you ever
with
drive
two
with 2 feet?
I used to have stick shifts, yeah.
Okay. Used to.
Yes.
I love having a stick, man. It's the best.
That sounds weird.
Yeah, it did. Play the song.
Play the Manly song. Man.
This was the podcast, but now it's over. But that's okay, because you can listen to the regular show on the radio every day. It was the podcast.